From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in three letters that have sparked intense debate. TPP, we're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a proposed trade deal in the Asia-Pacific region that involves 12 countries, including the United States. Now, President Obama has become a leading voice in support of the deal, while some leaders in his own party, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, have pushed back. They've been railing against the secrecy of the agreement, as they put it. And we want to take some of your questions this hour as best we can about understanding not only TPP, but how trade can impact really the Rochester Finger Lakes region. In many ways, we talk about trade and the Trans-Pacific Partnership as the kind of deal that is an international or national agreement only, but in many ways, it is a local issue. Bob Duffy, the CEO of the Rochester Business Alliance, wrote an op-ed recently supporting it, and I want to bring in some folks who can help us understand what's going on here. First, let me welcome Bill Simpson. He's the Vice President of the Global Supply Chain for Gleason Corporation. That's a company that focuses on the technology of gearing in automotive, aerospace, and other sectors. Bill, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Sure, Evan. Glad to do it.
Well, and I want to make it clear as well to the audience that we expect to be joined at some point in the hour by some labor leaders locally as well. But Bill, let me start with you. Part of what you do in working with the global supply chain for Gleason is working with partners wherever you have them. And for those who have written to us already this morning saying that this is a national issue, it's an international issue. What's the local impact of TPP? What do you think?
Well, generally with trade agreements, and without exception, every one of them that the U.S. has negotiated or been a part of has had a tendency to lift exports and increase exports, which increases demand on our products, which increases the need for raw materials, which increases the need for supply chain. Whether that supply chain be domestic or it be an international supply chain, that demand creates a need for raw materials and services throughout the world.
Bill, some of the criticism has been that the TPP has been too secretive and that there is just not enough known about this publicly, that those who have read the bill aren't allowed to read the language, I should say, the agreement, aren't allowed to talk about it. Is that a valid criticism?
Yes, I would say it is. I share in that criticism. There was a piece in the Rochester Business Journal a couple of months ago where I made that statement. The secrecy of it makes it difficult for businesses and companies to plan and really understand what impact a trade negotiator is going to have on their business without knowing the details or without participating in the creation of those details. So secrecy has been a concern and a legitimate criticism.
We're talking to Bill Simpson from Gleason Corporation about the TPP. I see the phone ringing. We will get to your calls and questions this hour and blame your host listeners today. I do have a couple of folks from the labor community joining us, but it's been a long back and forth over the last 10 days or so, and the host made a mistake on certain communications regarding the time of today's broadcast. So we're going to hear from them here momentarily. You know, Bill, in some ways, this debate about trade agreements comes down to, for many people, Senator Warren and certainly many Democrats as well, but I think I don't want to just categorize it that way, concern about protecting workers, standards, et cetera. When you take a look at this kind of a potential agreement, are you concerned about protecting workers, standards, et cetera?
Growth in an economic environment and the creation of wealth by creating these supply chains I mentioned earlier will take care of workers' living standards. That's part of the economic value chain to do that. It's not about misplacing workers or sending jobs offshore. That's really not it. That's a false discussion. It's about growing the economy locally, which maintains and creates jobs and allows the economics of paying those workers to maintain their living standards.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. And again, you're hearing from Bill Simpson from Gleason. We're talking TPP this hour. And let me grab Chris in Pittsford, who's already called in with a comment. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment, which might even be a question briefly, is that the Cuomo administration, according to the state comptroller, has done a very, very poor job with this startup New York, where, you know, tens of millions of dollars have been spent on advertising to get manufacturers to move into, especially areas like Western New York, where we've seen some major job losses over the last three or four decades. It looks like our bang for the buck on that is very, very low. And I guess my question to the guest and to anyone else would be, what indications do we really have that the average worker in Western New York will in any way benefit from this giant trans-Pacific trade pact? Thank you.
Chris, thanks for the phone call. Bill?
Okay, well, it's a good question. The Rochester area, and Gleason in particular, are one of the largest exporters. And if you look at it on a per capita basis, we're not only one of the largest exporters in New York or in the East Coast, but in the nation on a per capita basis. So it is difficult to do business in Western New York, but trade agreements are not the driver of that. Unfunded mandates, costs to imposed on workers, on not workers, sorry, but on businesses, high taxes, you know, they cause disruption for businesses, and it makes it difficult to become cost effective. But those companies that are able to manage those costs and able to increase their exports do and can be successful in Western New York.
Let me get a comment from Lee. Lee writes to the program and says, Evan, in general, I'm inclined to oppose this kind of agreement, but I appreciate your guest at least agreeing with the idea that there should be more transparency. Does he have any idea why there isn't transparency? It's a good question. And before we even get to that, and Lee, thank you for the question and the comment there. Before we even get to that, I want to make sure we get a comment in or at least play some sound from Senator Elizabeth Warren on this. She was on Rachel Maddow's show recently on MSNBC just regarding who has read the language and who has not. So if we can listen to Elizabeth Warren on the TPP, let's go ahead and listen to her comment, and then we'll ask Bill about that same question.
Senators can go and read it. People in the House of Representatives can go and read it, but we're not allowed to talk about it. So now it's the case that the president says that he wants the American people to judge this deal based on the facts. But to do that, he's got to make the deal public. Otherwise, the American people can't judge it on the facts. You won't put the facts out there. The press should be able to see this. People should be able to dig into it. If it's a great deal for families, like the president says, or a great deal for workers, then put it out there and let them see it before we have to grease the skids to get the deal done.
All right, that's Senator Elizabeth Warren. And again, Lee, that the soundbite you just heard was sparked by a listener named Lee's question on why is it this way? I don't have a great answer for that, but Bill, do you?
I don't know if it's a great answer, but I'll give you my viewpoint on it. I was a little troubled, as I mentioned earlier, Evan, about the lack of transparency or the secrecy of it. But I do understand partly the reason for it. When you have a multinational negotiation going on like that, especially one that's gone on for many, many years, I think we're probably in our 10th year of negotiation, 18 or 20 rounds of negotiation. If those details are leaked or made known as the negotiation continues, it will tend to extend or attenuate that agreement for much, much longer, particularly when those pieces of information are exposed to members of Congress who have districts and self-interests at stake, and an assessment of those self-interests could cause immediate opposition. You need to let the trade negotiators who have assume they've been responsibly chosen and are gifted and qualified to conduct such negotiations. You have to give them an opportunity to conduct the negotiations at a time when it is required to get more input. At that point, it can be revealed, but you can't negotiate every single point in public. It simply makes it an unwieldy process. So although it's uncomfortable and it makes some folks unhappy, the secrecy, because people don't know or understand the impact on their business, there is a legitimate reason to keep it confidential while the negotiations are going on.
Back to the phones. Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The idea of capitalism is to make the biggest amount of profit as possible. And when you have wages in China and Bangladesh that go for about $10 a day, that is where you're going to send most of your investments to make the biggest amount of profit, whereas maybe they're $10 an hour in Rochester. Apple phones makes all of its iPhones, iPads, and so on in China, where they pay them $10 a day. They could build a factory in downtown Rochester, but they would have to pay $10 an hour, $12 an hour, $13 an hour, rather than $10 or $12 or $13 a day. That is what these trade agreements are all about, the ability to send investments overseas, ship the products back into the United States and Western Europe and Japan at no cost or at low cost. That is what it's all about. Nothing else.
Okay, Don. Hold on, Don. Let's just pause for a second and give Bill Simpson a chance to respond. And again, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the various issues related to trade deals like TPP with Bill Simpson, who's the vice president of the global supply chain for Gleason Corporation. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. Well, first of all, I disagree with the premise of the caller. And one of the reasons for that, if Apple were to bring a factory to Rochester or any other high-cost state within the U.S., they certainly wouldn't be selling products as cost-effective as they are. And it's not all about labor. I mentioned earlier about supply chains. The labor cost of that equipment is a relatively small amount, so it's not the biggest bang for the buck.
Most the supply chain
Hold on, Don. I will absolutely let you respond, but I do want to have Bill have a full point. Go ahead, Bill.
Right. Most of the cost of products is not necessarily labor. Okay. You've got material cost. You've got transportation cost. Yes, you have labor costs, but it's generally not the largest amount of any product. Okay, so you have to look at the entire supply chain, and when you're done looking at the entire supply chain, then you have to look at the cost of the end product to see what the market price will be in the markets you're trying to sell that product. And if you can't make it affordably or cost-effectively, and consumers can't afford it because the costs are too high, you're not going to sell a lot of product. So it's not all about labor.
Let me ask you something, Bill, and then I'll let Don come back with a rebuttal. But
Yes. You've
been using the term cost-effective, and I think that, I mean, I certainly understand what you mean by that, and I think our listeners do as well. But in recent years, there have been more of a debate about what cost-effective truly means and whether we ought to be willing to pay more for products if that means we are investing in higher wages or better work standards. What do you think?
Well, that's a consumer's choice, and it's a company's choice. If they feel that they can sell a dress shirt for $100 versus selling a dress shirt for $50, and if they can do that and customers want to buy it and you want to pay $100 for a dress shirt, that's the consumer's choice. I don't know that companies actually think they'll be successful selling basic products at very high prices just for some, you know, made in USA patriotic reason. Consumers are consumers, and they want the best value for their dollar, whether that product comes from the United States or it comes from Canada or Mexico or it comes from China. They want the best value for their dollar earned. They want to spend it effectively.
Well, and Don, let me turn that question around on you then. I understand the points that you were making in your initial comments, but why not, as a consumer, say, hey, this is a chance for us to work within free market is such a wide-ranging term that I'm not sure any market is perfectly free, but you can vote with your wallet. And if more consumers vote with their wallet, if you don't like certain standards or products that come from places that you don't like either the wages or the standards, et cetera, then companies will respond to that lack of business there, won't they? I mean, don't you think, Don, that consumers have the power?
Well, I believe that if the consumer doesn't have any money in his pocket because the jobs that exist are so low-paying that they can't afford to buy back what's being produced, then they don't have any choice but to buy lower-cost products. Also, in addition to what he said, you know, maybe labor isn't the biggest cost in his calculations. But he can't control things like the cost of transportation or the cost of raw materials. The only thing the capitalist can control is the cost of labor. And by sending jobs overseas to take advantage of lower wage rates, that is the one major thing that they can control. And they will do that. And then the wages will fall here in the United States. So maybe at some point in the future, jobs will come back to the United States, but at what wage rate? It's just a race to the bottom, because that's the one thing that capitalists have the greatest amount of control over is the cost of labor.
Don, thank you for the call. Bill, a response on that end?
Again, I don't want to get into an argument with the caller, but capitalists and business people, yes, they have some control over the cost of labor because they can establish an hourly rate, but the laws of supply and demand really establish what the cost of labor is. Okay, it's not set unless you're an advocate of this minimum wage debate that's going on, where you have a government entity coming into a supply-demand situation and artificially establishing a baseline for labor. That is a disruptive effort. But supply and demand and skill establishes the cost of labor, all right? It's not under the control of the so-called capitalists. And to make a final point relative to capitalism, capitalism is not an evil philosophy. It's capitalism that causes the economy to work. It's capitalism that creates jobs. It's capitalism that puts money in your pocket. It's capitalism that allows you to live. It's the profit motive is not an evil motive. The profit motive is a positive motive.
All right, let me grab Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, in addition to the things that people have been saying about criticizing the overall potential agreement, which I agree with what the last caller was saying, I think one of the things we've gotten into, and it's very frustrating, is that we have become so dependent on the corporate world, which largely is the realm in which we're talking about for so many things that, talk about capitalism, it just increased their power without going through lots of detail. Basically, that's what really has happened. So instead of spending a lot of time talking about what we can do to maximize our people's opportunities, such as the recent discussions around employee-owned and worker-owned co-ops, which I realize, seems like a small piece, but if you look at countries like Spain and other places, it can be a big piece. And the advantages of this is not only the obvious that the workers have a lot more say and ownership in what happens, but the profits are shared. It brings brings a sense of community. So it's unlikely that the business is going to go over to overseas to get a bigger, better deal or whatever, or outsource a lot of stuff. So all these things, we spend so much energy on these issues with the trade agreements and all that, and the past ones, that we have minimized these other approaches, which I think should be the other way around. I realize we're not going to end trade, and it should be kind of a fair trade deal anyway. But we really need to spend a lot more energy on doing things that people have expressed interest in and that really would stabilize the country more. And actually, and a big one, I think, in addition to those, is to enhance neighborhoods. We have too much poverty, and these options would help much more than worrying about, well, do I have a job today? Am I going to be paid $2 a day? That kind of thing needs to be let go of to a certain extent and refocusing on what is a much better option. And also, these are options that have to make some profits too. But it's just that it's not billions of dollars of profit.
All right, Bonnie, thank you for the call. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there was a question in there, but I did want to agree with you for the most part that when the employees have a stake in the success of the business, it sharpens the focus quite a bit. And anyone that has expended their energies and their intellectual property into a business should participate in the profits and the spoils of that business. They put their effort in. They should certainly take reward out. And whether it's employee stock ownership plans or co-ops or other employee-owned endeavors like that, that should absolutely be a part of the economic fabric of this country. Because I don't disagree with that at all. I'll make one further comment, because it's not all about big corporations. Most, two-thirds or more of all the jobs that are created in the United States are created by small business, small and medium-sized business. You have your large corporations, and they tend to get all the press relative to corporate profits and so forth. But the vast majority of jobs and the vast majority of employees work for small and medium-sized companies. That's where the focus should be. And if government wants to help, that's where they need to relieve the burden. Relieve the burden of taxation, relieve the burden of regulation, relieve the burden of government mandate that causes high costs to small and medium-sized companies. And that will then unleash capital and allow these companies to then hire more people. But I absolutely agree with Bonnie that co-ops and employee-owned and employee participation endeavors should absolutely be part of the tapestry of this country.
You're hearing from Bill Simpson, Vice President of the Global Supply Chain for Gleason Corporation. That's a local company that focuses on the technology of gearing in automotive, aerospace, and other sectors. And in studio with me now as well is Erin Young. She's the lead organizer for the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation, AFL-CIO. Erin, thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you as part of the conversation. Our phone lines are lit up, which is just an indication of how much interest there is as we talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, trade agreements, et cetera. We've been talking to Bill about some of his perspective with a company that is so strong in exports and looking at the potential benefits of this kind of deal. From the labor perspective, Erin, I understand you have some concerns about TPP and deals of its ilk. Let me start there. What are some of the labor community's chief concerns with this deal?
Well, there's a number of concerns, actually. I think that we are, A, uncomfortable about how this deal has unfolded. This has been put together behind closed doors. Even our own Congress members who we elect to represent us have only been allowed to glimpse at it, not take notes, and then asked to leave.
And they're not allowed to talk about it afterwards.
Exactly.
That is true. Yeah, that is true.
So if this is so great, why is it so secret? So we have that concern. We're very, very pleased to see at least the currency manipulation issues attempting to be addressed. So that we consider a small victory, but we have a long way to go. After the hundreds of thousands of American jobs that were lost after NAFTA, we don't see how this is going to improve anything here. It's not going to improve the economy. It's not going to bring jobs here. Let history kind of tell a tale. So we have that concern as well. So what this comes down to is we have a democracy here, and poll after poll has shown that Americans more than 2-1 oppose this deal. And it is primarily because they believe in being able to purchase more American-made products here at home. That's the answer to all of this and the economic issues that we have.
Here's a comment from Rich online who says, Evan, I support trade in general, but I'm under the impression that we're already trading with the dozen partners in this agreement, aren't we? I'm still trying to understand what specifically would change under the TPP. Bill Simpson, let me start with you there. How would you answer Rich's question?
Well, I think, as Erin just alluded to, the one point that we do agree on in her opening was that we are concerned with the secrecy of the agreement. So I'm not sure I can answer the caller's question without knowing the details. We do trade with Japan. We do trade with, the other countries, with Chile and with Canada and with Mexico, and with many of the other countries that are in that agreement already. Vietnam, New Zealand, there are others that we already trade with. I think this round of negotiations focuses on certain areas relative to investment, relative to intellectual property, relative to currency manipulation and things of that nature, services. So until more of the details are known, I really can't comment to the caller's question specifically.
Well, and Aaron Young, go ahead.
It is our understanding that the biggest piece that would change in all of this, because yes, we do trade with these countries. However, part of TPP removes any type of standards or regulations that we currently have here. In other words, safety regulations, any type of food and quality regulations. It's our understanding that TPP removes that to an extent where if the country that we are trading with, if their profits are hindered by our regulations, they can essentially sue us for that. So we don't see how that can benefit anybody here, nor do we want the quality of our products going down as a result. So this is yet another major concern, and it's one of the major differences.
Let me grab John in Rochester, who's been waiting to jump in. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, you know, I'm a supporter of Milton Friedman and, you know, supply-side economics and capitalism. But I have to say, if you look at, when I think about Ross Perot and the giant sucking sound back in 92 that he said that was going to come, it kind of came. And I just, ironically, today I saw an article which showed that in 1990, 40 of the states in the union, their primary economy was based upon manufacturing. Today it's 7. And that's been replaced by health care and social assistance. And I don't think that's a good thing. So I see some drawbacks in this trade agreement and other trade agreements. The other thing that I want to bring up also, and I'd like to get Bill and Aaron's take on this, is on legalizing illegal immigrants. To me, labor should be against legalizing illegal immigrants because it creates a supply of labor and reduces labor value. And Cesar Chavez, who was the head of the farmers union back, United Farm Workers in California back in the 1960s, actually formed militias to stop illegal immigration. I think labor should take that also as part of their fight to get higher wages.
John, thank you for the call. Bill Simpson, I'll start with you.
Well, yeah, let me try and address a couple of the, well, several of the points that were raised. One of them, I think Aaron mentioned about the quality of products going down. I'm not a subscriber to that for a couple of reasons. One, if the quality of products is going to go down, consumers simply won't purchase them. Consumers know how to spend their own money, and they're going to seek out value and They won't be buying the products if the quality that they expect is not there. And that will retard trade in the countries that are exporting their products into the United States. There won't be a large influx of low-quality products. So I think we need to give the consumers some credit that they know how to spend their money. Relative to the manufacturing statistics that the caller raised, I can't speak to the details. I don't have details of service industry versus healthcare versus automotive versus others. But as some low-skilled jobs leave, other higher-skilled, higher-paying jobs replace them. And that's part of the economic ecosystem. So it's not a zero-sum game where one job is lost and nothing comes back. There's generally a benefit to reducing what I'll call low-wage or low-skilled employment and replacing that with higher-skilled, higher-paid employment. One additional thing that I should bring up for full disclosure that wasn't in the introduction, Evan, and that's in addition to my global supply chain responsibilities, I'm also the vice president of operations for our Asia machine tool operations, one operation in China and one in India. And as far as quality standards and safety standards and the welfare of workers, we bring our standards to the countries where we manufacture. We have the same quality standards. We don't produce anything in either of those countries that is of lower quality than what we produce here in the United States or what we produce in Europe. So quality is a, we keep a high standard, worker safety, high standard, standard of living, Social Security, all of those are kept at very high, high standards in the companies we run in Asia.
You're hearing from Bill Simpson with Gleason Corporation. And before I kick it over to Aaron Young, Bill, just I have to ask you, you never know throughout a given decade which little sound bites are going to stay with your memory forever. But John brought up giant sucking sound, three words that everyone remembers from Ross Perot's presentations in the 1990s and 1992. Was Ross Perot right about NAFTA?
No, I don't believe he was absolutely not correct about NAFTA. If you look at the expansion of trade between Canada and Mexico and the United States during that time, I mean, the U.S. has exported in triple digits. Their exports have increased to Canada and to Mexico, and vice versa. Canada is our largest trading partner. And when trade increases, wealth is created, and the economy moves forward. So I don't agree that the giant sucking sound, it was a sound bite. That's not reality.
Aaron Young with AFL-CIO had a bit of a pained expression on her face listening to some of that. Go ahead, Aaron.
Imagine.
Well, well, you know, you have to look at the facts, you know, pre-NAFTA and post-NAFTA here. You know, we can't ignore the fact that 72% of Americans here in the United States receive subsidies, okay, and work full-time. You can't ignore that 42% of the population here makes under $15 an hour, which is not a wage that sustains a family. What happened between then and now? This country was built on manufacturing, and it's not about high skill versus low skill. It's about quality jobs. It's about giving people the ability, regardless of the skills that they offer, you know, to give them the ability to take care of their families and be able to pay their bills and be able to spend money here, thus, requiring a need for more services and more construction and more. I mean, this is a cyclical economic fact that has proven itself time and time again throughout history. So I would wholeheartedly agree that NAFTA was not, I mean, it wasn't the only piece, but it was one of the biggies. And it completely turned around how we purchase products, how we've lowered standards. Our wages here have not kept up with inflation. And to respond to some of the things that the caller brought up, you know, this is, we always take a position where we do not believe that taxpayers should have to subsidize all of these workers out there. If somebody is working full-time for a living, they should be able to support themselves and their families. We need to eliminate cheap labor. We need to provide quality labor here. And everybody should have a shot at the American dream and have the ability to do that. If people want to work here, they can pay taxes here. So that is kind of where we stand as far as all of this goes.
Now, Aaron, let me just ask you to clarify one point there. And I don't say this pointedly. This is just to help clarify, because sometimes we speak a little bit more abstractly. And you say you think someone with a full-time job should be able to support their family. And we hear that often, especially in the context of debates over minimum wage, fight for 15, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But someone who's working full time should be able to support how large a family and support on their own? What kind of wage are we talking about?
Well, you know, now we're getting into details. But if you take a look in the 70s of what the cost of living was versus what the median wage was, let's start there. And you know, everybody, depending on the size of their family, depending on where they choose to live, there's adjustments for that. But you take a look at what the cost of living is today and what the median wage is, and it's frightening. It's absolutely frightening. We have been in a downward spiral for the last 30 plus years here. And this is not, you know, you hear, you want to talk about a soundbite, you hear about the race to the bottom, and that's where we're headed. We are in a mad race to the bottom.
Well, Bill Simpson, with wage stagnation, I don't think we can debate whether wages have gone apart from top to bottom. We do know that the top is making more, the bottom has less, and we can debate about what has caused that. But are you concerned about that, and do you think these trade agreements, some of our callers seem to think that, yeah, they point to NAFTA or others, they seem to put these trade agreements on the table there. What do you think are driving some of that stagnation of wages?
Well, first of all, I'm not troubled by it. If an individual or a corporation or a company or a small business or an entrepreneur uses his intellectual or her intellectual property to better themselves and make a product that people sell and they make money at it, good for them, as much as they can make, there should be no limit to that. So I'm not troubled by it. I also want to bring into the discussion, you know, we're talking, you know, we bring up the labor cost. It's like, it's everybody's working in a menial job, and that is simply not the case. Let me name a few companies since the 70s that have done quite well and prosperous, and their employees, of which there are hundreds of thousands, actually do quite well. Facebook, Oracle, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple. I can go on and on. There is a transformation, I call it a different industrial revolution that has gone from, you know, strictly blue-collar jobs to jobs that are still blue-collar in a sense. Someone still has to do the work. But look at what the internet age and entrepreneurism in the internet age has done for wages.
But do we still have to make things in this country? A lot of people will say, they're hearing you, Bill, but you're talking a lot about intellectual property, and we're not talking about what manufacturing really means anymore. Are you concerned that Americans don't make things the way we used to?
I'm concerned that we don't make as many things, and that I will share that. I'm in manufacturing and have been in manufacturing for my entire career. And so building things, making things, designing things, innovating things is a core competency of this country. Look at globally where all the patents are, or where all the inventions come from, and all the entrepreneurism. Most of that comes from the U.S. and the releasing of our intellectual power. So, yes, I wish there were more things made here in this country. However, as part of capitalism, as part of responsible management, you have to look around the world and make your products where they're most cost-effective, there's that word again, so you can sell them reasonably and make a reasonable profit so you can continue to invest in your business. That's a fiduciary responsibility of any leader, any manager of any company. That's a responsibility that we have.
I am miles late for a break, but I know that Aaron Young, the lead organizer for the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation, AFL-CIO, wants to respond to that. And in a moment, we're going to hear from Jim Bertolone, president of the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation, AFL-CIO. Bill Simpson's on the line with us, vice president of the global supply chain for Gleason Corporation, and your phone calls as well here. So much more to try to squeeze in as we talk TPP for the last 15 minutes of the hour. Short break and right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we'll talk to author Carlo DeVito, who has written the previously unknown story of the founding of Arlington National Cemetery. Robert E. Lee and his wife once lived at Arlington Estate and Manor. They had to leave when Lee decided not to lead the Union in the Civil War, and their estate became the grounds for Arlington National Cemetery in a story of revenge and tragedy. We'll tell it to you next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Doyle Subaru on Ridge Road in Webster, featuring symmetrical all-wheel drive vehicles for all-weather driving, including the 2015 Subaru Legacy. Doyle, serving the Rochester region for more than 70 years. More at doylesubaru.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. All of our guests are generous with their time on this program, and sometimes the host is just a little less than generous with his organization. So Jim Bertolone's here with AFL-CIO. He's the president of the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation. And Jim, first of all, thank you for forgiving the host for mixing up
certain times.
I know we'll have a lot more to talk about in many future days. I know you want to start by responding to some of what you just heard from Bill Simpson from Gleason, who said, number one, he thinks there are legitimate reasons maybe for some of the diverging wages. He said he's not concerned about that specifically, and that, sure, we could be making more things, but that's a function of an economy that is, in many ways, functioning effectively.
I totally disagree. Some of those places he named, like Apple, 90% of their employees are in China. They're not in here anymore. As a matter of fact, they got cited, Apple, on their i6 phone, even in China, for working people 80 hours a week for weeks without a day off. What we have seen, one thing I think I should start off is that Rochester Labor and myself belong to business labor groups that include the Coalition of Prosperous America, which includes, as our co-chair, Bill O'Shaughnessy of Revere Copper, the American Association of Manufacturers, which includes Corning Glass. And a lot of American companies feel they can compete with anybody on a level playing field. All of our products have health care on them. That's why so many of our cars are made across the Detroit River in Canada, because it's in our labor costs. We're competing with countries that have Medicare for all. Every country in the world except us and a couple of third world countries has either a VAT, a value added tax, or a BAT, a border adjustable tax at the border that averages 17%, some of which goes back to companies to level the playing field on labor costs and on regulatory costs so they're competing on an even keel. Germany, the Scandinavian countries, are the highest wage countries in the world, and they all have a trade surplus because they use a VAT and a BAT. And it's not about trade. We're all for trade, but it's about net trade. When you run trade deficits north of $10 trillion, which we've run in the last 20 years, that is a net loss of jobs. You can't tell me that we've closed 2,000 factories since 2001, and that's good for American workers or American middle class.
Bill Simpson, there's a lot to chew on there, but let's start with the VAT, the value-added tax. Yes or no?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I have companies and plants in Germany. There's also companies in China. The value-added tax is simply another burden on business and the consumer that prevents them from spending their money on other things. Would you rather give 17% on top of what else you're paying in taxes to the government, or would you rather spend that 17 cents or 17 euro on food or clothing or entertainment or something else? It's simply another tax that inhibits the free flow of capital for goods. It's another cost to business.
Okay. I don't think we're going to find common ground on that one. That's okay. But Jim Bertolone, before I try to go through as many listener comments for the rest of the hour as we can, just real briefly here, we've been talking about the framework of trade deals like this. I know part of the comment you just made was a trade deficit, and we haven't talked much about that. Bill Simpson, is there a sense that, first of all, are you concerned about a trade deficit? And second of all, is the TPP the kind of thing that would impact our trade deficit?
To answer the first part of that, yes, I would say I am concerned about it. Whenever you're running a deficit, whether it be government debt, trade, your own bank account, that is an imbalance, and it's a problem that has to be funded from somewhere else. So chronic deficits and so forth, they are a problem, and they are an inhibitor to economic growth. And that, on that point, we agree. So that is a concern. And, Evan, what was the second part?
Well, will the TPP impact our trade deficit? Will it improve it?
Well, that's hard to say. Generally, trade agreements will. It goes both ways. It depends on what the countries are exporting, what we're buying, and what we're exporting. Generally, we're, as I mentioned earlier in the show before Jim and Aaron joined, in almost every trade agreement, without exception, exports out of this country to those countries that we've agreed with and negotiated with, exports have gone up. You know, part of the problem is imports have also gone up. So I can't really say specifically with the TPP whether that will help the trade balance or not, but it certainly will open up opportunities for business and consumers in the 11 or 12 partners that are involved in it.
All right. Barbara writes to us, all Americans, regardless of political persuasion, need to know that the multinational corporations will be gaining expanded power to sue state and local governments over regulations those governments may pass to ensure the well-being of their local citizenry. Such lawsuits could impose great financial costs on local communities and undermine the quality of life desired by those communities. Jim Bertolin, concerned about that?
It happened yesterday. That's a very timely question. Cool. We were sued by Canada and Mexico and ruled against by an attorney from the WTO that's not an American. COOL stands for Country of Origin Labeling, and it's on our meat products. Both Republicans and Democrats, this was bipartisan. American consumers, no matter what their political party, want to know if the meat they're feeding their family came from corn-fed beef in Iowa or from a steer in Tijuana. We lost that. Now, that could rescind the law, and it opens us to a lawsuit from both Canada and Mexico for taxpayers to foot the bill for profits that they're going to allege they lost because of country of origin labeling. And that's the problem. For one thing, it's hard for me to buy what little we know about the four chapters out of 29 that are on trade. We know from WikiLeaks. Nobody can see it. Even our Congress people can't see it, how you can back a trade agreement that we can't see. And to address Bill, our surplus with Mexico from NAFTA's turned into a deficit. Korea trade agreements turned into huge deficits. Those represent lost jobs. What we have here is just the opposite of the free market with some of these agreements. The drug companies are extending their patents so that you can pay $120,000 for the one-year treatment, the one pill a month to cure hepatitis C, and not because they have to go in the Himalayas and get a flower to make this, but because they can. That's what's going on.
All right, Bill, brief rebuttal, and then I got one more question from a listener directly for you, but go ahead and respond there.
Okay, on the Korean piece, again, a lot of that is on the manufactured goods side, there is a deficit there, but it ignores the fact that services and other trade aspects with Korea have grown. As far as the pharmaceutical companies go, part of the reason the pharmaceutical companies extend that and need to make money is because of our regulations here in this country. It costs pharmaceutical companies a substantial amount of capital and years of investment to commercialize a drug. If we want to make pharmaceuticals cheaper for the consumer, we need to address the regulatory labyrinth that's been put in their way. That's what raises the cost. It's not going to the flower in the Himalayas.
All right, Bill, here's Ronald writing to the program. Mr. Simpson fails to point out that Apple uses near slave labor in China. Amazon has been accused repeatedly of unfair labor practices with their warehouse labor. Is that hyperbole? Is that unfair, Bill, or is that fair?
Well, I would ask the person who wrote that how many Apple factories he's visited in China, but I think it's hyperbole. I work there. I know, I see it. Yes, there is certain labor practices that are unfair. There are certain labor instances where workers are taken advantage of. That's what makes the press. That's what makes the public. It's not what the vast majority of companies doing business in China. That's not how they act. That's not how they treat their workers.
All right. Some final thoughts, Jim and Aaron. And we've been talking to Bill Simpson from Gleason about Trans-Pacific Partnership and some other issues as well. And, Jim, I know you joined late. Some final thoughts here.
Well, some final thoughts. Most of the R&D we've seen, for example, Bill mentioned drug companies, is paid for by the taxpayers. I mean, you can confirm that over with our esteemed president at the U of R and Strong, who they do great work with government grants and researching drugs. We saw 1 million people die a year for a number of years when AIDS drugs were available. in Africa and in Asia until George W. Bush stepped in with the taxpayers' money because Nelson Mandela was threatening to go generic with all these people dying. I'm the last generation, the kids who went to school in the 50s, that got polio. And under today's TPP rules, myself and or 50 to 100,000 children a year would be in wheelchairs or dead because of polio being eradicated. These trade agreements, we now have a country, University of California, 42% of Americans are working for $15 or less. 87 people have nearly as much wealth as half the world's population. This is not good for the world. It's not good for America.
Jim Bertolone, thanks for coming in and joining the program, and Aaron Young as well from AFL-CIO. And wish we had another hour for all the calls and comments that have come in. Bill Simpson from Gleason Corporation. Bill, thank you for taking the time as well.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
All right. And again, this is just one of those subjects that we're going to need more time. We're going to need more days to discuss, and we'll do that on this program. Short break, and more with you next right here on Connections.